Ever feel like your WordPress site is moving in slow motion? Switch to Kinsta's Managed Hosting for WordPress and watch it fly. Host your site on Google Cloud's fastest servers with worldwide data centers so your pages load instantly. Need help? WordPress experts respond in under 2 minutes and will migrate to your site for free. Try it yourself. First month free at Kinsta.com. That's Kinsta.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Great to speak with you. I wanted to recognize some of the interesting countries where we are being listened to. There are some where there were many listeners 2 weeks ago in the Cayman Islands. And in Sweden and Austria, Australia, Canada, Great Britain, and of course, the United States. And then for this past week, in Australia and Canada, New Zealand, Austria, and South Africa, which I am really intrigued about, as well as Norway. So, if you are from any of these places, please, please be in touch. Let me know what speaks to you in your part of the world. And so for today, we have a really interesting guest, Ryan George. Ryan George spent the first 20 years of his life in a cult, attending a series of independent fundamental Baptist churches, including one where his dad was the pastor, whose word was the ultimate authority. It wasn't until Ryan was confronted with the truth that his father was a serial sexual abuser, hiding his sins behind Bible verses, that Ryan realized his faith was built on a foundation of lies. He spent the last 25 years reevaluating what he truly believes. And miraculously, while he left the spiritually abusive IFB movement, he didn't leave behind his faith altogether. In his new book, Hurt and Healed by the Church, Redemption and Reconstruction After Spiritual Abuse, Ryan details the spiritual and physical abuse he endured during his childhood, how he was confronted with the truth of his father's secret sexual abuse of minors, hidden for decades, and how he managed to untangle his personal faith from the harmful tenets of American fundamentalism and the teachings of Bill Gothard. Here is Ryan now. I am so very happy to be talking to Ryan George today. It is so good to talk to someone who can approach this from so many different angles, you know, when you've had your own personal experience and also when you've had the task of needing to put it into story form. You've already kind of synthesized it and figured out how to put it into words, which is a really wonderful thing. It's very healing to go through that process too. Not an easy process, but it's really good to be able to talk to you. And I would love to hear about your own personal story, about your book, all of it. But if you don't mind just taking a few moments just to introduce yourself and then we'll get started.
Yeah. So I'm Ryan George. I'm Crystal's husband. I'm Deani's dad. I'm a stay-at-home worker for the last 20-some years. I started my company 22 years ago. I'm a virtual assistant. So I have a lot of flexibility to write. So blogging led to book writing. But all that goes back to, I'm a world traveler and an adrenaline junkie. I've been to all 7 continents, both polar circles, looking for the divine everywhere around the world and frankly finding it. But my spiritual journey has been an interesting one because I've actually been baptized into 3 different faiths. And so, and I've been surrounded by even more. I'm much more of an open mind, I guess, than a lot of people in my family. But what brings me to this episode is I just released a book talking about that journey of coming out of an abusive faith and finding freedom and reconstruction.
Right. So I'm sure through doing all of this, you've been able to connect with a lot of others who have been through similar experiences. And of course, what makes yours unique too is that there is a tie to family, which adds to the emotion, which can add to feelings of betrayal at times and to anger and a lot of other emotions that can come up. And so I want to make sure that we talk about that too. The fact that you were baptized or you've been baptized in 3 different faiths, which ones?
So I started out my life, my parents were arguing whether I'd be Lutheran or Catholic. And my dad won that one. And then my mom left both faiths and joined the IFB, the Independent Fundamental Baptist Movement. A couple years later, my dad joined that. About a year after that, I went to a vacation Bible school where they had a live sheep in the in the church. We were all like, oh, wow. And they're like, you should give your life to Jesus and get baptized. And so I got dunked. And then after deconstructing and leaving the cult about, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years after figuring out that what I grew up in isn't what I wanted to be, I joined a non-denominational church by, again, getting baptized and saying, you know what? I don't know if what I had before was real. So I just want to start over, like fresh slate, like go around the board of Monopoly and start at 200 again.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting. Yeah. And to have a sheep there, I'm sure it was like, ooh, good. I mean, before understanding the symbolism of it, but still. So I would love to hear about your upbringing and then what caused you to eventually leave, I think, what was prescribed for you and find your own way, which is not an easy thing to do, especially when your family is so inextricably tied to the traditions that you're involved in. So you were raised, it was in New York, or was that later on?
We moved around a lot. That's part of my story. My dad, after he joined the movement, he's like, you know what I need to do is I need to be a pastor in this movement. So he went back to college at like 30 years old, I think, 29, 30, and went and got a degree in Bible. Well, he almost finished a degree. Then we mysteriously left Tennessee and then we moved. He was an intern pastor and a Christian school teacher in Pennsylvania. And then in the middle of the school day, we just up and moved to another state and the church paid my dad for a year, year and a half to disappear. We don't know now if that was going away money or not. But and then he started a church on an island in the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland. And so I spent, I don't know, 12 years there. And then I left for college to go to IFB college. And that's where I met my wife, who did not grow up in the cult and in that line of thinking. Her parents were missionaries in South America in a pretty remote place at the beginning. And then they moved more toward a metro area as she got to college, but they just like needed a place to drop off their daughter and like, well, she'll be safe there and it's cheap, you know? And so when I went to leave college, the only faith I knew at that time was that IFB faith. I was never allowed to explore beyond that. I couldn't even go to my grandparents' church services. Or my aunt and uncles. My aunt and uncle are Anglican. My grandparents are Lutheran. My other grandma was Catholic. I was not allowed to even attend their services. I was not allowed to be intellectually curious, religiously curious. And so when I left college, I just went right to an IFB church. And after a couple of years, my wife, she said, I mean, I can't do this anymore. 4 years of college was enough. And so at that point in my career, I moved to take a job here in Virginia where I live now. And I said, tell you what, you know what? I owe you. So I'll let you pick the church. And we started going to, it was still a Baptist church, but it wasn't in the IFB movement, but it was an international church. We had people from 14 different countries. Almost all of them, there was at least one immigrant in the family, if not both partners. And so it opened up a world to me of how much church, of how we define church is culture. Like to me before it was you're either in or out. There wasn't different ways of doing faith, right? And seeing, oh, well, that's how they do it in Southeast Asia. This is how they do it in Colombia. This is how they do it in Brazil, whatever. I started to realize, oh, you can do church different ways and even believe some of the same things. And so then after a few years of that, I was really struggling because our services were primarily in Spanish and my Spanish is horrible. And so my wife said, hey, why don't you go find an English speaking church? And that's where I found the church where we've been attending for the last 18 years. My wife's on staff there now. I've served there almost every Sunday for 17 and a half years.
Right. Okay. And so, and you mentioned also that you have a child. So not that we have to disclose anything about your child, but
no, you're good.
I just, you know, I find it really interesting when people talk about the way they were raised and how then it informs how they are as a parent and also how much guidance they give, how much they pull, how much they push, or how much they let the child kind of jump into following what they think speaks to them, you know, how much individuality they let their child bring to the discussion. So I have a feeling that was important to you.
Yeah. So my dad was physically, verbally, spiritually abusive to me growing up, beat me, hung me, froze me in sub-zero temperatures to try to quote unquote cool me off, threatened to knock my teeth out. He would quote the rule from the Old Testament that a child, when they're disrespectful of their parents, deserve to be publicly stoned. And so he's like, any abuse you get is less than what you actually deserve. So there's a lot of shame. He told me that I was going to hell. Just anytime that I didn't fall in line with the what he wanted, particularly homeschool, I really struggled with being homeschooled, which is a big part of the IFB movement. And so I was just scared to be a dad. Physical abuse and verbal abuse is multi-generational in my family. My dad was abused. His dad was beaten by my great-grandfather with chains. Apparently, one of my forefathers, I haven't been able to find this book, but it's family lore that there's a book written about one of my forefathers, and it's called like The Meanest Man in America or The Angriest Man, something not good. And so I was afraid of continuing that chain, of adding more links to that chain. And so after a few years of marriage, I told my wife, I don't think kids are an option. And I got all three versions of a vasectomy to make sure I wouldn't make a baby, you know? And we weren't in foster training. We weren't trying to adopt, nothing. I was on a helicopter expedition up in British Columbia, and I get back to cell service and I get a message from my wife saying, hey, the law enforcement officers have placed a young lady in our care. So when you get home from Canada, just, you know, there'll be somebody in our house. And we just kept saying yes. We'd have these big conversations like, hey, should we try to get protective custody? Yes. Should we try to get long-term custody? Yes. And eventually, should we try to adopt her? And I said, well, let's do it. And so 2.5 years ago, we made it official. And so Deani became our daughter at the age of 18. So she's a junior in college right now. And to your question, we have not, she doesn't share our faith. She doesn't not share our faith. It's just not a priority for her. And we've given her a lot of grace to figure out what she believes. I think one of her biological grandparents was a pastor. And so there's some baggage around that as well. And so what we know is it took me a while to figure things out, took my wife a while to figure things out. So we've just given her a lot of grace for her own spiritual journey.
That's really quite an amazing gift. And also a gift to give to someone who is older, who clearly then is going to have a whole history, and to give her a stable family and a life and safety, which has been very purposeful and is something that you've really needed to work to make sure that you could provide before you provided it, which is very responsible. And yes, you do hear that a lot about abuse being passed along from generation to generation. And sometimes it is because of the modeling. Sometimes, you know, it's like nature and nurture. Sometimes you're going to have sociopathic people who are going to hide behind the Bible as a means of getting away with being sociopathic. And so, you know, with previous descendants, you know, in your family, your ancestors, it sounds like it got really dangerous and not at all healthy psychologically or psychiatrically, actually. And so your dad then, with the list of things that you said that he did to you, and I'm sure there's more because that was, you know, just a quick list, it's still really shocking and really startling. And the fact that you lived through it is quite amazing, actually, as you think about it. My goodness.
Yeah, I didn't have a lot of choices. I was really looking forward to college. I started saving for college probably in the ninth grade. Like I was ready to get out. I ran away from home a few times after the worst of it. You know, when your body is all in the frenzy mode, I chose flights. So yeah, so I was ready to go to college, even though the college was just as strict, if not stricter, than my dad. You know, they had such weird rules. Like I couldn't walk on the same sidewalk as a girl, couldn't use the same elevator. They were so worried about me having some sort of consensual sexual connection with a female, when it, to me, it's just ironic with how much physical abuse and sexual abuse is rampant in the IFB movement. It's almost like they create the rules to protect themselves from themselves. And they just assume that you need to be protected from yourself as well.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great insight. And I talk a lot about, and with on the podcast, but also with clients, where they were raised in these hyper-sexualized and hyper-abusive places, but then were taught to be so afraid of their own impulses and afraid of themselves and what they would do to other people, and also afraid of somehow letting people on, leading people on, like being the women, especially the girls, that somehow they're like this siren, you know, that makes the boats come and crash on the shore. And they have this power just from walking around. And that is a pretty dangerous idea, too, that, you know, if something happens to a woman, she somehow invited it just by being. And so there is something really powerful also to hear you talk about kind of setting up rules so that people get protected. They get to protect themselves, maybe their own reputations, and maybe also they can get away with it more because they're coming across as people who were so against it that people then might not assume they're up to it themselves, which is what happens a lot with people in positions of authority in some of these places. And when you were talking before about your dad maybe being sent away and maybe it was sort of hush money, already you were alluding to the fact that there was more potentially that he was up to that you just didn't know about, even with all the things that you did find out about, that maybe there was more.
Yeah. So it was interesting because for me, I got treated differently than my younger siblings. They didn't get the anger. They didn't get the physicality. And so the way my parents sold it to me was I was the problem. I was the irritant, not my dad. He wasn't the problem, right? And so in high school, I think it was my senior year of high school, my mom, who's, again, my educator, I'm home educated, sent my dad up to my room to tell me that she'd thrown in the towel on me. She was done being my mom. And like, it's your problem, right? Like, you're the one that won't fall in line, right? And so you can start to internalize that to go, oh, like I made dad do this, right? Which then, of course, you could see why I would be in a superstitious faith because I'm worried about making God get angry at me too. But to what you're alluding, yeah, we would find out years later that my dad has a series, and we don't know how long the series is, of sexual assaults on teenagers. My wife is actually one of the breaking moments when our family finally dealt with all the allegations was my wife saw my dad or overheard my dad grooming a 9 and 11-year-old talking about how the women in Song of Solomon were praised for their body parts. And Crystal, my wife, rips her earbuds out. I was like, wait, what? Like, no. And she went and talked to their parents, but their parents didn't know the stuff that my family knew. And so for them, it was just out of character. They're like, that's not the Pastor George we know. You know, and there's other like record scratch moments. I remember, so in the IFB movement, in the fundamentalist movement of Baptist faith, there's this real big push for door-to-door visitation, like the Mormons and Jehovah's Witness, et cetera. And I remember we were canvassing our island, going, you know, neighborhood by neighborhood, and my mom and I were paired together, which didn't happen a lot, but it was true then. And we came up to a door, and the lady, we've never met her before. I've never seen her since. I don't know her name. But we're like, hey, do you have a faith? Do you have a church? We'd love to share ours with you. And she said, well, where do you go to church? And we told her, and she said, oh, I would never go there. The pastor's having an affair. My mom's standing next to me, which has got to be completely awkward to hear that next to your son, right? She goes, no. That's my husband. I would know. And this stranger looked through the screen door at my mom and said, ma'am, you don't know your husband. And so later, as different allegations came out, we'd hear him in different places. My dad would call him affairs. And so now we wonder, was like, did that lady actually know about something underage? I think the oldest victim we know about was 19. And it started before she turned 18. Like, it was a series of events. But yeah, it's we just don't know the extent of it. We don't know, was that the reason we moved? You know, my dad had a 3.9 GPA in Bible college. And the reason he told us we left is because he didn't want to take Hebrew and Greek. He just wanted to get on to ministry. That could be true, might not be. When we left Pennsylvania, it was, well, I want to start my own church. I don't want to be an assistant anymore. But I mean, we left in the middle of a school year and my parents were two of the four teachers in our little Christian school. So it just, you're like, what in the world? And not even at like the end of the semester, like we just left in a random day in November, right? So I think it was around Thanksgiving or something. But yeah, so we just don't know the extent of it. But what he did to those girls was different than what he did to me, which is different than how he, you know, he was verbally abusive to my brother in different ways, but nobody experienced my dad the same way. And so nobody thought to check in on everybody else because I didn't see him getting angry at anybody else at church physically, right? And those victims didn't see him doing anything sexually with somebody else. And so what my dad was really good at was making sure that everybody doubted their own expression of him, right? Like nobody would believe me when I said, hey, my dad beats me and tells me I'm going to hell, right? Like who's gonna, my sisters would believe me because they heard it through the walls. But outside of that, everybody else that my dad had molested or done something angry or done something verbally or whatever, we all had our own version of him and we didn't see it anywhere else. And so it's almost a version of gaslighting, not that he had to gaslight us verbally, but that we didn't ever see it anywhere else to think maybe I'm the problem, right? Maybe I am, he's not doing this with anybody else. So maybe it's me.
Right. Oh my goodness. Yeah. I was actually thinking about gaslighting when you were talking about that, you know, when people are exposed to something, but then their whole way of interpreting it is shifted, then they don't know if they have a leg to stand on, if they are going to complain about it or report it. They don't know if it's going to come back on them, which is what would have happened with you because you already were the quote unquote problem. And the idea that kids, you know, spouses, anyone is blamed for their own abuse is
gross.
It is gross. It really is. It is because there's no excuse for it. And so let's say you were even, let's say you were doing things that you shouldn't have been doing. I don't know. Let's say you decided to start a fire in the middle of your living room. Fine. It's still not okay for your dad to try to do any of the things that you mentioned, right? There's never an excuse for abuse. But also what you want is if a kid is quote unquote acting out, I always have trouble with that phrase anyway, but if they're quote unquote acting out, what they want usually is for someone to put their arm around them and to say, what's going on? Like, you seem upset or agitated, or you're trying to let us know.
I'm still here.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And so many of the people I talk to who have been shipped off to some of these teen treatment places, who were incarcerated, put in juvie, whatever, they will say to me after, no one said, how are you doing? Or is there a reason that you're doing that? Or are you angry about something? Or are you just wanting to go, hey, I matter? Or I'm really mad about how I'm being treated and I'd love someone to notice that. And I don't have the words for it. So instead, I'm going to try to escape this house for my own safety, or I'm going to yell, or I'm going to do something. But kids are always, it's like babies, you know, when in a lot of fundamentalist groups, babies are taught to, you're taught to ignore crying, you're taught to ignore everything, because somehow that's a manipulation. Well, it's the same thing as teens and as adults, you know, we use our tools to get our needs met. And it's the people's job around us to a certain degree to say, I think I just heard a cry, or I think I just heard a yell or something that should make me stop and notice and be supportive rather than punitive. But, you know, with so many of these groups, the reaction is totally punitive.
Well, and beyond that, so not just did my dad not wrap his arm around me, I remember one time I said, "Dad, I'm going to call social services on you. I'm going to report you for abuse." And he looked at me with a smirk on his face. He's like, "Do it. How much do you love your brother?" And I was like, "Shit, man. Like, you can't do that, right?" Like, he was a poker, before he was a pastor, he was a poker shark. And so he was calling my bluff, right? Here I am, a teen, just wanting someone to say, no, you belong in our family. And instead he's like, "Okay, we'll blow it up. I don't care." And so you can imagine the weight that puts on you then. I was talking to my counselor today about it. She said, "Your time in my office, I've been, I don't know, 220 sessions with her, has been a journey to not feel responsible to parent your siblings, because you felt like you had to get them out, get them safe, get whatever." Because from high school, your dad was saying, "Go ahead, blow up the family. This is on you. This is your fault, not mine."
Yeah, it's pretty sick. And yeah, that is a burden that you're going to carry if you're a good person, if you want to be a good sibling. But yeah, just wanting to be told that you belong in that family, I'm just thinking how much more emotional it is as I hear the story about your own child now, that you gave her that gift of saying, "You belong in our family." And that is a really beautiful, very healing thing for everyone involved, which is really lovely. So here you were trying to just figure out, I think, how to make it through the day, and being pushed and pulled, emotionally speaking. And then you couldn't wait to get out. I'm sure you couldn't wait to get out. And so where did you go when you left?
As far as cardinal directions, I went 3 of the 4 compass directions, and I couldn't go the other one because there was the Chesapeake Bay in the other direction.
Okay.
But I would walk 6 miles. I think one time I walked 9 or 10 miles, maybe 12 miles away. I walked, in fact, the one time I almost got shot because I got to my buddy's house. He was significantly older than me, and I didn't tell him I was coming. I didn't have a cell phone. This is in the 90s. You know, I just took off. I didn't take water, nothing. I just started walking, and he said, "I thought you were an intruder," and I was ready to go. Other times, I remember I'd run away to work, actually. I would just go to work. Like, I wasn't called into work. Right? I would just walk to work or walk to a friend's house. One time I walked to, I was supposed to babysit the next day, and I think that was 6 or 7 miles away. I jumped on my bike on that one. And I just said, and I showed up at the house a day early, and the lady said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I need a place to sleep tonight." And she's like, "Okay, you can stay here, but you can't tell your kids why you're here, my kids, why you're here early." So yeah, I went whatever direction my dad wasn't. And they would eventually send someone for me. The guy who almost shot me, he took me to church the next morning and handed me back over to my dad. Everybody would always hand me back to my dad, right? I'd ride my bike home from the babysitting job or walk home from work. Eventually my shift's over, right? Like, yeah, it was anywhere I could get on foot or on bike. I didn't have a car, you know, so I was really limited in physically how far I could get from my dad. And my dad would even challenge me sometimes. He's like, "Go ahead." He's like, "But you got to come home sometime. Like, you can escape this wrath now, but I'm still going to be angry when you get home." Or even like foot races. He's like, "You can run, but my dad was a star athlete in high school. His football team was undefeated all 4 years he was in high school. And he would let me know, like, I can catch you. Like, you're not going to, he didn't have any weapons in the house. We didn't have guns, but he knew that I couldn't outrun him, you know?" And I remember a lot of the violence started to escalate, and a lot of his frustration, when he turned 40, we had a foot race in the driveway. We had a long rural driveway. We lived on a soybean farm. And he's like, "All right, let's race." And I smoked him. Like, I absolutely smoked him. I was 13 or 15 or whatever it was. And that, from that day on, man, it was.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm very satisfied to hear that you smoked him. And that is delightful. And with his personality, yeah, you were going to have to pay for it.
So I'm significantly taller than my dad. My dad's 5'8", I think, and I'm 6'2". And he did this, all his calculations. Like, "Well, you wouldn't have won. I did, you know, my stride's shorter, so my legs are moving." I was like, "Dude, you set the terms of this race, and your whole family just watched me beat your ass. Like, I can't change that." It's like, I won.
Right, right. You know, it's interesting with all those calculations and all of that. I think he thought that he was outsmarting you and deciding that he really won because of different mathematical things. But when an adult does that, "Well, you know, that's how I hear it. Like, uh-huh, but..." And it's like they couldn't handle it and they come across like a child. And well, that's not fair. That's, you know, like in my head. But I think that he thought that he was coming across like he was this wise person who was able to inform everyone about how he had really won. I don't know if when people with his personality do these sorts of things, I don't know if they realize how they really do come across to people and how they sound like children who just can't lose. Because in these ways, he just didn't grow up. Because you, as an adult, if someone wins a race that you're in with them, you'd say like, hey, congratulations, good job. Like, you know, no harm, no foul. It was fun to do it. Because you're coming from a different place, a healthier place, a more confident place, a more mature adult place. But he revealed how much he was a child, it seems, probably a lot.
Yeah, and that carried on to me. I mean, my biggest struggle in life is with insecurity. One of the reasons I went to all seven continents, and I do all kinds of weird adrenaline stuff. I go out on the wings of airplanes while they do aerobatics. I jump off of buildings and mountains and things. And part of it was to make the world think that I was worth something, right? Like it was, so yeah, I definitely got that. I understand how my dad got there because I got there. And I'm sure the messaging he got growing up was not great either, right? Like I have to give him some grace to go, what example did he have? His dad was super insecure as well. And so I don't know. Part of you, you go, I give you grace because I can understand how you got there. But the other part is, if I can break the chain, you could have broke the chain as well.
Right, exactly right. And I also think about the adrenaline, the push for you to, I think, to push the walls out. Like here you were trapped, right? You'd go to people and then they'd bring you back to your dad. That's a trap. Because then you're being brought back to this person who's going to be even more pissed. Like, how do you get out of this? And then to be into adrenaline, there is something very addicting about it because it helps you not feel a whole variety of other emotions. You know, you can just be on a high and just be in this sort of, it's dissociative, actually, right? That's how you're able to do these things. And I'm sure it felt nice to be there. But it also is when you're saying, I just really wanted to know that I mattered, that I could be seen for being able to do these things. That is still qualitatively different than I think what your dad was doing. And this is to vilify him 100%.
Right.
You're right. He's a victim too. But you were saying, look what I did. And he was stepping on the backs of others to raise himself up and say, look what I did to this other person. You know, that feels very different to me.
Mm. It is addictive. I don't know that I would have originally said that it was because I was running away. And one of the things an adrenaline rush does is it takes your peripheral vision figuratively down really small. You're not thinking about the bills on your desk. You're not thinking about any tensions in a relationship. You're not thinking about, you know, whatever deadlines you have at the office or whatever, something hard in your life. It really simplifies. You're thinking, I got to go grab the handle for that chute, or I need to make sure that I grab this harness, or, you know what I'm saying? It really simplifies life. But it did become addictive. I never got into alcohol or tobacco or drugs or anything, but there's a lot of science behind becoming addicted to that dopamine and to that, that purge, right? To go, okay, I just purged a whole lot of emotions out of me. I remember the first class that I took in wing walking, where I go down the wings of the plane, when I landed, one of my classmates asked me, he's like, what do you feel right now? And before I ever got out of the plane, like we're yelling across the tarmac. I'm like, I've never felt more alive. And part of that is because I didn't have to feel all the things I used to have to feel growing up. I didn't have to feel the tensions of running a business. I didn't have to feel the tensions of different relationships, definitely my family ones. But it's still a form of escapism and disassociation, right? Like, as my counselor would tell me, you're like, these were the protective things that you built around yourself to not feel the full feelings. And it really, and I lay this out in one of the chapters of my book, I can't remember which one it is, but the year when we confronted my dad, the year was the same year we got our daughter into our home for the first time. There were all these big things. There was things shifting in my work, the emphasis of what my business does. There's all these things in my life that were upheaved. And that was the year I did more adrenaline stuff than I've ever done in my whole life. And only looking back was able to go, well, why was that year the year I traveled and got out of Dodge so much? And why was it that I did the most extreme stuff? Why was it I finally got life insurance? I was like, oh, it's because everything on the other side of the ledger was bigger than it's ever been as well.
Interesting. So it was compensating for the totally stressful things that you were taking on in real life too at the same time. That's interesting.
It's like Instagram knows it too. Like when I'm having the hardest day at work, so like tomorrow, I'm probably going to have to be in the office for 12 or 14 hours to get all of my deadlines met. That's when I'm most susceptible for influencer posts about a country I've never been to or some sort of adventure I haven't done yet or haven't done in a while. You know, it's like, man, you guys even know when I'm hankering for getting out of my office.
Right. So when you go, you come home and you say to your wife, we have to go to Malaysia tonight. She'll say like, did you have a rough day at the office, honey?
It's so funny because I have, so through my business and the level of American Express card that my business has, I get like $5,000 to $7,000 of airfare for free every year. And I've even started to notice, like intentionally, when I go check my balance of points, that is a red light on my dash to go, hey, dude, if you're checking how many points it is, maybe you should check in with your counselor today or a friend or go for a walk or have a prayer time or whatever it is.
Right. It's great that you can do that, that you can look back and think what's going on here. I mean, I wish more people outside of someone's life would do that. Like the people whose home you show up to when you're supposed to be babysitting and you show up a day before. I don't know if people felt like they could get involved, and sometimes people don't want to get involved, but if they could have said like, what's the pattern here? Like, what's going on? Why is it? Right. But it's good that you can do it for you, which is really actually important. And so I'm curious also then when you were able to go away to college. So tell us about that experience. Where did you go and what kind of school was it and what were you studying?
Yeah. So I went to a summer camp in like seventh or eighth grade, and my counselor at the camp went to this extremist college. It was an offshoot. The founders had graduated from Bob Jones University, which is in the news. They were real public in the 70s and 80s for fighting to be segregated in the 70s, like in my lifetime, to stay segregated. My college broke off of that, trying to be more conservative than them. To tell you how conservative we were religiously, and by the way, the college is in Matt Gaetz's district, so that tells you a lot too. But to tell you how conservative they were religiously, my senior year, they released a series of videos that we were required to attend about how liberal Bob Jones had gone with their theology. Like they're like, hey, before you go home, we want you to be able to out fundamentalist anybody that you know from Bob Jones.
Wow, that's fascinating. And right, if you talk to people who've gone to Bob Jones, as we have, they'd be very surprised that they're being called liberal in the slightest. So that does paint a picture. My goodness.
My freshman year, yeah. The guy who lived next door to me, his fiance, I think she moved down because they had gotten engaged and she wanted to be on the same campus. And she went to Liberty University in the 90s, which back then was even more conservative than it is now. And the joke that they used to play on people at Pensacola, where I went, was they're like, oh, what brought you down here? And she go, oh, I got saved. And they're like, oh, we're so glad. Like that was believable. Like we thought Jerry Falwell was a liberal outpost.
Wow. My goodness. So Pensacola. Okay. So what were you studying while you were there?
So I majored in commercial writing, which showed up 20 years later when I started writing books. And then I minored in advertising public relations. And so I've always been good in my life to spin things to find the positive. This sounds really funny, but one of my heroes early in my career was President Bush's press secretary. I was like, that's amazing. Like he can take all this bad news and turn it into good stuff for the president. So I went into auction advertising out of it. So auctioneers all over the United States and Canada and Europe hire me to get people to come to their auctions. But I was one of the only guys in my major. It was a new major at our school. I was the first student ever to get a perfect score on the senior writing portfolio project. I was winning awards everywhere, but they didn't want me to go out and work for a secular publication. They didn't want me to work in an ad agency. They wanted me to work for missions agencies and churches and whatever, because they said, we want you to only work in ministry. Like their view of it was, we are only training you so that we can give ministries multifaceted employees.
Interesting. I mean, it's also interesting that here you took these classes in writing and at the school and then wound up writing a book, probably also mentioning the school in it.
Actually, I don't mention my school at all. My first book I wrote right after I graduated, we didn't have a television until September 11th. And so I just started writing a devotional book when I was still in the IFB movement. But I did not use the King James Version of the Bible for my scripture references. And so I wrote back. I was the first person in the writing program to get a book published. And they wouldn't allow me to sell it on campus. I was like, man, I'll bring them for free. We'll do signings. Like, this shows off your major that it's working. And they're like, we want nothing to do with you. And it's so cool because I hear other people that get hounded by their alma mater for like donations and stuff. I got blacklisted from my college after corresponding with the vice president about why he wouldn't sell my book on campus or even let it be on campus, you know? And so, yeah, I got in their not good favor very quickly.
Uh-huh. That's good. That worked out great.
Must yeah, I don't mind. I get less uh-huh. mail that way.
Exactly. Exactly. Wow. Yeah. And I'm sure you don't want to have to keep being asked to donate to something like that over and over again. Just is going to bring up a lot of feeling.
Not that they need donations. So Pensacola, a lot of people don't know this. Pensacola is the originator of Abeka Books, which is the largest homeschooling and Christian school curriculum in the world. And back in the late 90s, early 2000s, they were turning, I had heard, close to $500 million a year. And so they would, one of the reasons people went, including my wife, to this college was, at the time, they had to take the profits out of Abeka Books and put it somewhere so they wouldn't have to pay taxes. So they poured it into the college. And so they would spend over half of campus worked for the college, like work study program. We would do things like so manual labor intensive rather than just buy a machine because they needed to spend the money to keep all these kids on the payroll. And so it was just a weird situation. Like, my wife worked in the distribution center that shipped the books. I did grounds crew for them, but there were people worked in the print shop, people drove the trucks, whatever. It was student labor everywhere. And they've infiltrated the world. Like, Abeka Books is everywhere.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Yeah, no, that sounds like that's not kosher, so to speak, on so many levels. Right.
But it got me a cheap education. I did 4 years uh-huh. of college for less than 20 grand. So I only owed $600 when I left college, which a lot of people my age, I'm in 46, they either haven't finished paying off college or they recently did. And I was done my Christmas bonus, my first year at my first job, I paid off college.
Wow, that is incredible. Yeah, usually it's this albatross hanging on for many, many years to come. Okay, so that is a bonus. We'll give you that, right?
Sure. Again, I'm great at finding the silver lining.
Right. And so then here you were, you know, traumatized, needing to, throughout your lifetime, figure out how to survive, how to even feel about yourself. Because here, if you're blamed for your own abuse and you have no one to go to kind of square it away in your own mind and get clarity, you know, that whole process of figuring out if you are this bad seed or not is a journey. That's a hard one. And it can feel so relieving when you're told that it wasn't your fault. But I know that it's a challenge to believe it. And so I'm glad that you're, you know, getting some assistance with that. I think I wish more people did do that. I mean, I think that whole process of opening up to someone and having them guide you to like have perspective and see whose fault something is and whose it isn't is really important. I wonder then after college, then what happened? I'm just wondering about, you know, then getting married and that whole process. And then also at what point you took your dad to task for these things? At what stage was that? I don't know how recent or how long ago that was.
Yeah. So if you want to do it linearly, so my dad officiated my wedding. That's just gross, knowing what I know now. But he told me, he's like, we don't approve of your wife. And it was interesting is the line he said is, your wife's going to bring you down spiritually, which the opposite of that is true. Like, she's only been a force for good. As I'm talking to you right now, she's doing a retreat in Ukraine for aid workers to help them do trauma recovery. She took 5 counselors from here. And it's a faith-based, faith-adjacent, I should say, process to help people who are helping others process trauma. That's the kind of wife that I married, right?
Wow.
And so, but that he was a threat. She was a threat to him. She's bilingual because she grew up in South America, and she takes trips down to Nicaragua. At one time, I think she was taking like 3 or 4 a year, but she would translate and she would lead, and we would work with, or she would work with women coming out of sex trafficking. And when they would take counselors down from the States, or they would take just even parishioners from our church down, they would do these pre-trip meetings where they would say, hey, this could be triggering. Like, if you've got anything associated with this in your past, we want to work with you now to prepare you, or maybe even keep you from going. Maybe you wait to go. And in one of those meetings, one of my close friends said, yeah, back when I went to Ryan's church, when we were both younger, Ryan's dad did X, Y, and Z. And so that was 2012. And I went with the victim. I was so honored. The victim said, would you go with me to confront your dad? I said, yeah. I mean, I just can't believe. Yeah, I will do that. And we drove 5 hours from here. We live in the Blue Ridge Mountains. We drove up there and she confronted my dad. She's like, hey, I'm not here to press charges. I'm not here to, you know, threaten you or whatever. I'm just telling you that what you did wasn't okay. And you're like, people know now, like, this isn't a secret anymore. He worked some Bible verses and stuff against her and said, hey, you don't tell your family, don't tell my family. It can't help the gospel, all this kind of stuff. And I was still transitioning my faith. And I was like, you know what? All I know to do is make her feel safe. So whatever boundaries she puts around telling the story, I'm going to follow her boundaries. And she chose for 7 years not to tell her family or my family. And so I'm carrying this secret. And my dad knows that I know, and he knows that my wife knows. And we're going to family Christmases. I remember one family Christmas, my wife was sitting out on the front porch with my dad alone. And she's like, hey, Pastor George, like, have you looked into Celebrate Recovery or Sex Anonymous or any of these, you know? And he's like, you're not allowed to talk to me. You're not a legitimate member of our family.
Wow.
So that's the angst that we had. And it got to be so much as I was bearing this victim's story that I couldn't even sleep in my parents' house. I would take one of my backpacking tents and my 0-degree sleeping bag at Christmas, and I'd sleep out in their backyard because I just couldn't even sleep under the same roof. Well, the incident that I told you about earlier. So my parents had like a pool and kids in the neighborhood, you know, swim in their pool, whatever. And that's when my wife overheard about the grooming situation about Song of Solomon. And that's when we went back to my dad's victim. Was like, listen, we think this is a pattern. Like, we don't think you were a one-off. And so we decided she was going to tell her family and then she was going to tell my family. And when she was telling her family, I was in the same room with her, but next to her while she Zoom called all of them. And then I got to be with her when she told my family. I was there on site. She actually wanted to talk to my mom in person. So I went with her for that. And my siblings, as you can imagine, each of them took it a different way. Some believed us, some didn't. Some stood with the victim. Some said, hey, we don't want you around. You know, we don't want that story being around. You can be around, but we can't talk about this. So then that was 2019. So 2021, my wife and I were on our vacation for our anniversary. We come back and there's a 2-hour long podcast from one of my dad's victims with all these receipts. Like, and her story would have come earlier in the timeline than my friend who lives here. And one of the most damning things in that interview was that when they have witnesses to this, when they went to tell my mom said, oh, not again. So now we don't know, when did this start? We don't know when it ended. We don't know how many there were. And so at that point, when that came out, most of my siblings were like, yeah, this doesn't look good. Like, that we got to believe the victims, you know? We started recording conversations with my dad in 2012, or I did anyway. And so I kept them all and I put them up on Dropbox for my siblings. I'm like, here, you can listen to them, you know? And so we gave my dad some stipulations. It was me and my wife and a couple of my siblings. We said, hey, you can have a relationship with us again, but you need to get into counseling. You need to confess to your pastor. You need to confess to all the pastors whose churches where you volunteer. We just gave him all these healthy things to do. Like, you need to get healthy. And he's like, nope, not going to do it. We're like, all right, well, then you've set the boundary for our family. I've seen my dad twice since then. One was at my baby sister's wedding. I officiated that and he was there. And then my grandma's memorial service 2 weekends ago, just a few pleasantries here and there. But we're like, hey, we didn't make the call. You made the call. You didn't want to get healthy. And so, yeah, it's just been a wild journey of piecemeal, of learning a little bit at a time. And then sometimes dad will say, yep, that happened. And other times he'll say no. And sometimes we got on one recording, he remembered things that the victim didn't even remember. And then he tells us that, well, you guys are misremembering. And then when we confront him, he's like, oh, maybe I have early onset dementia. Like, there's always an excuse. He reminds me a lot of watching Trump, like when Trump excuses different things he does. He's like, well, you don't have the story right. I have the story right. And there's always an excuse and there's always somebody else who's to blame.
Yeah, right. It's so interesting. Actually, when Trump was running originally and then also became president, my practice flourished also during COVID too. It had this other resurgence. people were like, I can't hear that voice. I can't hear those excuses. I can't see. This is so culty to me. Just the laughing at people, the making fun, the public shaming, the fact that the next people in line were the ones to take the fall, not him. You know, like that always happens within cultic systems. Someone else takes the fall for you. But just the, I never said that in that very childlike way, you know.
And you're like, dude, we have the video. You said right. It yesterday.
Right, exactly. And it didn't matter. That was the other thing that was very gaslighty and culty. Like, here is the video. Well, it must have been doctored, blah, blah, blah. Or that person has some sort of agenda and that's why they're, but anyway, yeah. But all the predictable things. But it's interesting that your dad didn't want to hear, didn't want to see, didn't want to deal. And I guess that just keeps him feeling kind of emotionally safe because he's used to getting away with things. And I don't know how he would handle actually having to take responsibility for really anything. And also, it sounds like if he really were to look at everything that he's done, he would have to take responsibility for quite a lot. And so some people just intuit that that would destroy them. So they have to keep the lie. But what is really important in that story is that the person who was harmed got to say it and got to be heard and got to be heard by others too, not just by your dad, and got to be believed. Knowing there was a 2-hour podcast also, what was that like for you?
Well, I've only been able to listen to it once.
Yeah, I'll bet.
But I reached out to the victim because in the podcast, they thought I was covering for my dad. They put out on air, they're like, he must have known, he must have been covering for his dad. I live 600 miles away. I was married. I was enjoying married life. I had no idea. Like, again, I was out. I came home for family functions. I came home to watch my brother play high school sports. He was a gifted athlete. And then I would just drive back to Indiana. So I didn't know. So I reached out to her that night, the night that I found the podcast and or was given to me. And I said, hey, I believe you and I'll do whatever I can to help you find justice. And she said, hey, will you talk to my attorney who's working on this? I said, absolutely. And the next day he talked to me. He's like, hey, what? And I answered every question I could. I've spoken to the sheriff's deputy there in my dad's county. I'm willing to help. If my dad's not going to choose justice for himself, I want to help them find some closure by bringing that. I've done a good enough job that so far all the victims have thanked me and believed me. They've been okay with my book. One of the victims said, I can't read your book because it's too hard, but like, I'm okay with you going public with this. I changed her name in the book, you know. Her sister and I are going to be meeting up here in a week or so. She's like, hey, we haven't talked in, I don't know, 25 years, however long it was when I was in college. And so she's like, hey, can we meet you? And somebody else from their youth group that I had, again, I hadn't seen, they were my little sister's and brother's friends. So I didn't, you know, keep up with them. But yeah, so the fact that the victims and their families and those people know that I'm safe, like they can differentiate me from my dad. And one of the most redemptive things happened last week. I got to be on the podcast that broke the news about my dad. Like they had me on to tell, here's how I rebuilt my faith after finding out my dad was a serial predator from a podcast.
Wow. Wow. And what podcast is that?
It's called Preacher Boys. It focuses on...
Oh, yeah. He's been on, actually. He's a good guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's really good that it's being talked about. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you got lumped together with your dad, which is, I think, an expectable assumption. You know, that people are all kind of harboring these secrets and keeping the anonymity or the privacy of the person who's the perpetrator. Because when you're in a system where you haven't felt protected and you haven't felt like there is anyone coming forward or someone to talk to, then you can think people are also in on it, and it's just natural. And it's good that then you were able to make a distinction, like, actually, no, you know, I'm not the same here, and I'm not keeping the secret, and I'm not believing you. That's really very validating and empowering that you did that. And so, my goodness, so the whole process then of writing a book, tell me about that and when you thought that you wanted to take that on. That's a big thing. I'm in the process of doing that now. It's a big project.
So my last book is called Scared to Life, and it's about how I went around the world trying to scare myself into feeling, but I found God instead. All these different adventures, there's stories from all 7 continents about what aspect of God's nature I encountered when I went looking for something else. So like I got ambushed and blessed beyond what I was actually going for. So I was talking to a publicist and my publisher both about it. And they're like, hang on, before we get to that, just tell me your story. Like, how's your life? Like, how did you get to writing this book? And I started, and they're like, wait. Don't tell anybody that story. Don't tell any of those stories in this book. Because do you realize like the book that you have? And I said, what are you talking about? And they said, the fact that you had absorbed all of that and rebuilt your faith, that you didn't just deconstruct, you reconstructed, that now you're leading ministry and people are finding healing under your care, that women feel safer under you. Like, this is not a normal story. One, it's usually not, male victims don't write a whole lot of books in our culture, especially religious culture. Two, we rarely, if ever, I don't know if we found other, maybe one other, where the family member outside of the Duggars, where the family members of the abuser wrote the book, right? Like all these pastors in the news, we don't get a book from their wife or their kids or whatever. And like the fact that you're willing to tell that story, if you are, would be unique. And so those three factors, like, hey, why don't you go write a book about this? So I was actually doing promo for my last book, writing this book, and all that stuff, that podcast, everything came out 2 months before the publication date of my last book. And that completely changed the narrative, because now I knew my dad was a serial predator. I knew there was way more to it. There was more of a hook of a story, you know, for publicity or whatever. But part of it was going through, you know, I've been journaling and blogging through this journey. I've been, like I said, I've logged over 200 hours of therapy with just the same therapist, done EMDR, done all the different things. And the adoption happened in the middle of that, like dead middle of the middle of that. And so there was this redemption story of all the things that I learned and healed in me as a dad by trying to be a good dad when I didn't have that example, right? And there were just so many stories of redemption that I just kept writing about it. I got a book coach. I paid different levels of editors. I got an agent, you know, did the whole thing. And everyone was like, dude, we got to tell this story. I remember my book coach was like choking up and tearing up on the other end of a Zoom call. She said, do you know how many women are going to find freedom in your story? I was like, I don't know, like, but I'm willing to say it. And it has cost me. I mean, I've spent a lot of my own money to produce this, but also like I've been ostracized from my family. I was at my grandma's memorial 2 weeks ago and my family asked me to leave. They're like, you wrote a book, you're not welcome here. And so like I knew that was, I didn't know it was going to happen the way it happened, but I kind of knew I'm the uncomfortable. I'm the burr under the saddle. I'm the healthy in the midst of unhealthy. I'm the one that reminds everybody of everybody covering for dad and everything else. And so it's so funny. The comment I get from most people is, I can't believe you're willing to tell your story. Like, this must be so hard for you. It's like, no, because I see the redemption in it and I love telling the redemption side of it, but you can't set up the redemption without telling how you got there in the first place.
Good point. Really good point. But I'm curious also what it was like for you to be kicked out when going to, you know, your grandma's memorial, because when you become the black sheep of a family where you feel like you've already been there, but in a different context because you were blamed for things and things were your fault early on and now they're your fault again somehow. The black sheep, if we can call it that, plays an interesting role because they are usually the seers, the reactors, the ones who have a sense of what's happening and are the ones who are willing to call people on it. Sometimes they're the ones who are the outliers because they have a certain bravery, but they're demonized so often. But I see a lot of value in being that, but it's lonely. It says something about your strength and your character, I think, when you're the black sheep, but it's not a happy place to be. So tell me about what happened, if you can, if you feel comfortable. So you show up at your grandma's memorial and what happens?
Yeah, so there was like hundreds of people there. It was a celebration of life. So they're, you know, there's milling about. It wasn't like a church service or anything. They had had a private funeral just for her nuclear family. And then this was, we were all out of state. Her family is spread out. So what they did is they say, hey, 2-3 months from now, we're going to do the celebration of life so that you're not rushing to do plans, whatever. So there was nothing up in that, you know, we're eating sandwiches and, you know, catching up with family we hadn't seen in a long time. And then there was a gathering of siblings at the Airbnb and I went over to say, hey, and they're like, hey, mom's on her way over. Since you wrote the book, you know, I don't think that's going to mix well. Can you leave? And so I said, sure. And I left and my mom showed up. I literally, as I was pulling off the road, she didn't know it was me because I was in a rental car. She was pulling onto the road. I was pulling out and it was a changing of the guard. My mom has obviously struggled with this story her whole life. She's been betrayed how many times, you know? And I was a reminder to her, because I'm willing to tell the truth. The presence of me in the room is a reminder to her of all those things. The day that our daughter was adopted, I wrote a I wrote a blog post that I'd actually been working on for a long time, but I published it that day about, here's all the things that were redeemed about fatherhood for me in becoming a father. And when my mom read that, she told my sister three times, apparently, that I deserved to be abused 30 years ago for telling my story now. And so I knew a day like this was coming. I didn't know it'd look exactly like it did. And my chosen family in my church and in other, you know, I have kids who call me Uncle Ryan who aren't related to me. I have friends who treat me like a brother. I have men in my life who have, they carry a part of the fatherhood role in my life. It was a little bit easier. It still stings to be told, hey, we want mom here more than we want you here, which that makes sense. But hey, mom's not going to feel comfortable here, so could you leave? And so I did. I didn't make a fuss. I left. Those are costs that I expected. I wouldn't have written this book if I thought that wasn't a potential. I didn't know it would go down as it went down. But yeah, I had a premonition. The way I was explaining it to my brother the other day, we were talking about it on the phone. And I said, it's almost like how COVID accelerated so many things in our culture, like the work from home ability, like so many people wanted to work from home and their employers wouldn't let them, but now they had to, or churches, like some of the things that were fracturing in churches just got exponentially sped up because now people didn't have to meet. There wasn't the social construct that they had to hold or whatever. And I said, there were so many things in our culture that got fast forwarded. And I think that this memorial service a couple weeks ago did that for me and my family. It was like, maybe this was underlying and it just, we didn't have a inciting incident to get to the next level. And I said, I think we got there. And so, yeah, there's a sense of freedom in it that I don't have to perform, that I don't have to be the uncomfortable person in the room, that if I'm going to be considered the irritant with my health, with me being willing to tell my story, then I need to give that space back over to them until they're ready to follow my example.
It's a really nice way to think about it. And, you know, it can also feel personal when it's not necessarily, which is an interesting thing where there are a number of people, again, who I've talked to over these many years that I've done this, who have said, I aligned myself with a parent over someone else, like in this situation, over my sibling, because I still needed a parent. And I couldn't risk losing that relationship because I had already felt detached from my other parent. And, you know, and I don't want to then be an orphan with a parent still alive. And so it can sometimes feel like it's kind of a demonization of you, but it's a holding on of a parental figure. And you get caught in the crossfire of that, you know?
I've been able to replace some of that. So like I have men in their 60s, 70s who will say, hey, Ryan, I'm really proud of you, you know? Or they'll say, what you're doing here is really cool. Like the way that you make this space safe for other hearts, the way that you go first, the way, like, different things that my dad never said. So it works as a carrot instead of a stick. So my dad used a stick to get me out of his life. But at the same time, there are these mature, emotionally healthy men who are saying, hey, here's a beautiful thing. We like having you in our life. Like we like doing things with you. We really see this in you. Or maybe they slide me a book with an inscription. This book reminded me of your story or whatever, to where I'm not as afraid to make the jump, right? The other part of it, and I don't know if this is true, and I've talked to my counselor about this a few times, I think, but like there's a predisposition in me because I do adrenaline sports for fun that I know that the biggest rush comes after I do the hardest, scariest thing, right? Like, and that's a problem in adventure sports because if you stay in just one to chase that, you have to keep pushing the envelope, keep riding the edge until sometimes you find it. I mean, there's people who die doing some of the stuff that I've done, because they've gone well beyond the boundaries of where I participate in it to get that feeling again. It's like the sixth time you ride the same roller coaster, you can pose for pictures when the first time you were holding on white knuckles, you know, your body's doing the same thing, but your mind knows, oh, I can do this. And so I think there's things in my relationships where, yeah, I'm scared to have that conversation or I'm scared to do this thing, but I know that there's great reward waiting if I do the hard thing. And so I don't know if I'm predisposed biologically or just through, you know, years and years of exposure therapy, if you will, of jumping off of buildings and mountains and whatever else to go. Yeah, when I'm most scared, for instance, the first time I went to see a therapist, maybe the second time, I had, back then I used to wear an Apple Watch, and I looked down and my beats per minute went from 55 to 83. I was so scared about sharing my story with somebody else, but then I was rewarded for it, right? When your story is held with grace and people accept it and hold you like, oh, wow, that must be so hard. All of a sudden now I started to crave therapy, but for not for the adrenaline rush, but because it was a safe place. And so I think there's several factors involved. And part of it was a responsibility. I wanted to show my siblings how to get out. I wanted to show them the way. So I'm not responsible for the choices you make, but I can show you the way to do this.
I love that. And I think, yes, there is something about feeling like you've really worked towards something that makes the payout from it that much kind of richer and more satisfying and more well-earned. I mean, for some people, yeah, they can jump off a mountain, but they're having trouble thinking about having a difficult conversation or sharing something that had been a secret, right? And but you can be on the wing of a plane, right? But be afraid to tell something. And so it's different for different people based on their conditioning.
Oh, yeah. My wife's the exact opposite. She will have the hard conversation 7 minutes from now. Like, let's just rip the Band-Aid off, which has been good in our relationship. But she wouldn't go out on the wings of a plane, right? Like, and I totally respect it because I was like, you're actually, I wrote a blog post one time that my wife is the bravest person in our house. Like everyone thinks, oh, this is the guy who jumps off buildings and airplanes and stuff. I was like, no, the bravest person in my house is my wife.
That's so interesting. It's reminding me of the movie, what was it, Free Solo? But also just about his girlfriend, who I guess became a wife, who was like, no, I want to dig into being able to have a relationship with this person. Like, that's the work here, right? And he's holding on with his fingers to the side of the face of a mountain. So unbelievable. And he talked also about just like everything else is gone. You're just focusing in. I'm remembering also my conversation with Eric from Preacher Boys. Great guy. Really, really nice. And I remember he did a write-up of our conversation after saying it felt like it was a unique conversation because it felt like a therapy session. I don't know if he was expecting that. Sorry, it's a hazard. I'm a therapist. But I think I am just curious to ask you a question about that. And then I would like to also have you be able to talk about your first book, about you just finding spirituality in different places. What was his interest in covering this story? What drove him to want to really, you know, blow the lid off of this?
That's a great question. I don't know that I've ever asked Eric that. I think he is driven by an empathy. I mean, he's interviewed so many people from the IFB faith, which is what actually gave my dad's victim the courage to do it. She heard her own story in another episode and said, this guy's going to believe me because the church my dad preached, they didn't believe. In fact, they blamed her. There was a matriarch in my dad's church that came up to her after and said, well, what did you expect? Like, that was what she said to her. Her college, when she reported to her Christian college, which was again an IFB, you know, extremist college, they said, well, we'll kick the can to the pastors that he associates with in Maryland. They did that. And then they were like, well, he said he's sorry and God's forgiven him. So we're good. You know, her story was never held with the appropriate grace that it deserved, right? She was never told, that must be so horrible, I believe you. She knew, based on how Eric, again, as you've said, it's just a soft heart, that her story would be believed. And I think, I mean, he believed me from the beginning. Like he said, yeah, I believe that you weren't part of this, you know? And so I knew talking to him would be safe, even though, I mean, he's not a journalist per se, but I mean, basically what he's doing is expose journalism, going, no, I'm ask any question you want. You have proven yourself that you hold people with kindness and you hold their story.
Yeah. Oh, it's very nice. Really commendable. And yeah, and I'm so glad. I'm glad for you that you got to have that experience too. So I'm wondering about the first book and you traveling around and finding, I think, different examples, different iterations of God, godliness. You know, I growing up with a rabbi who was Reconstructionist. So what that means, right, is this idea that you can believe in God as a thing. You can also believe in godliness. Like if you don't believe in a spirit necessarily, that there is this something in people that you can either aspire to be or to provide or to try to find in other people or in moments when you see someone helping someone across the street. Is that God? Is that godliness? Either way, there's something beautiful, spiritual about those moments. It looks different to different people. And to make that all okay, I think is important, especially when people are coming out of groups where they're really trying to find their way and not wanting to be kind of pushed into someone else's vision of what that's supposed to look like and where you find it. So, but I'm wondering about the places that you went just in the last few minutes that we're talking and what you found in those places.
There's a verse in the Proverbs, you know, that is attributed, I think, to King Solomon or one of the other writers of Proverbs. And it says that God takes pleasure in hiding a matter, but kings and some versions of English translations say like rich men or something, like the powerful really get excited about uncovering it. It's almost like there's this spiritual scavenger hunt. And Jesus of Nazareth, in the different gospel accounts of his life, his biographers noted that he said, hey, if you want to find me, you can, but you have to seek for me. Like, if you knock on that door, I'll open that door. So it's almost this invitation, this hide and seek of like, I want you to find me, but I want you to come looking for me, right? And so I've claimed that promise, I don't even know how many dozens of times, before I get on an airplane or before I go have a conversation that's going to be awkward, or even reading a book, right? Like, part of my global exploration isn't just going to other countries. It's, I've read, I don't know, 300 nonfiction books over the last few years, exploring people of other faiths, of other views of sexuality or whatever. And what I found is that Jesus of Nazareth has kept that promise for me. Again, whether that's God or godliness, that's an interesting concept to wrestle with. But I have found an answer every time that I've prayed that prayer. And sometimes, the last year I went to Finland to do survival training up in the Arctic in the wintertime. And I said, God, would you show me why am I called to this? Why am I paying all this money to be tortured in the snow by a guy who trains their military? Like, what was? And the answer, I had the answer before I left JFK Airport, which was my holdover spot on the way over there. And I went, oh, and then other times it's been on a hike, or it's on the way home, or sometimes it's been after I like put together the photos to post online. I was like, what is the theme? What is something I've seen here? I've had all these intimate encounters, right? How in the world, almost mystical experiences. And when I put it through the filter of what was going on in my life back home right before I left, I go, oh, you know, and it's different every time. It's whatever I needed in that season to know. I only get so many feet in front of me. My headlamp only shows so many feet when I hike. It's the same in my spirituality. I only get however much my curiosity is getting illumined, the few feet figuratively in front of me. Even Antarctica, like, why in the world, God, would you bring me to Antarctica? And I'll give you that one. Is the IFB faith and a lot of fundamentalist culture defines itself by what it's not, right? Like, it's, oh, we don't do this. We don't do this. Our women don't wear that. We don't drink this. We don't watch this, whatever. And we were on the ship going down there, and there's no internet on the ship. There's no, I mean, you are, when you sail to Antarctica, you are in there's no satellite. Like, you can't even do GPS. It's middle of nowhere. And so they give you all these nature briefings and like science briefings to prepare you for getting down there. And one of our lecturers said, do you know what Antarctica means? And you can't Google it, right? So you have to be like, well, anti means. And so we're like, not the Arctic? He's like, yeah, opposed to the Arctic. It is defined, literally this incredible place with teeming with life and all these scientific discoveries is defined by what it's not. And I was like, oh. When I go home, I don't want to be defined by what I'm not for. I want to be defined by what I'm for. I want to be defined by, I'm a safe heart. I want to be defined by people can share with me. Like, people can find healing, right? Like, I want to be known. And the same thing with my faith. And so just little breakthroughs like that happen on every trip.
Right, right. Great, great, great to talk to you and to hear about your journey. And also the revelations, you know, being able to reveal what happened and hearing other people reveal their truth and how it's opened your eyes and other people's eyes to what can happen. And I think knowing also that you have this really lovely family unit now that is good and safe and kind, it is so good. No one, you know, deserves it more than the people who were robbed of it when they were young. So I'm so glad that you have that now.
Thanks for saying that.
Sure, sure. Wonderful to talk to you. I hope we get to talk again soon.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is great.
One more thing before you go. Wow, what a conversation. Thank you so much to Ryan for coming on the show. It is quite an incredible thing when you are talking about your cult experience, and that would be hard enough. But then on top of it, your father is a leader within the group. And then on top of that, your father is a serial sexual predator. And here Ryan is talking about all of it. He would have had every reason to not come forward. This is a very hard thing to do, but it's also part of people's healing, and it's a very good way of portraying things with the kind of accurate focus, with the focus on the right person, not the wrong person. It's a way of really gaining perspective when you're not the one who needs to carry the shame for someone else's behavior. You're not even the one who needs to carry the shame for not seeing what was in front of you. We don't want to see ugliness in front of us. And we don't want to see it in religious leaders. And we especially don't want to see it in our parents. So there was a lot of very natural resistance to seeing what was in front of Ryan. Also, because when people are leaders in this way, they often have people around them who keep their secrets. So if people are keeping the secrets, how do those who really deserve to know this information get the information? And how can people also keep themselves safe from a predator? They really can't. One of the things that I remember learning that I've mentioned on the podcast in the past was something by Dr. Margaret Singer, who was a professor of UC Berkeley, who studied mind control and coercion, and was a wonderful woman on top of it. But she also has this quote that I will never forget that she said at a conference once, which was, when you are in a controlled environment, you learn to deny the evidence of your senses. And so there were probably moments that Ryan was wondering about his father. There were probably moments where people were coming forward and he was told not to believe them, but he might have believed them. And we like to be able to keep blinders on for as long as possible. One of the things that helps, though, when you take the blinders off is it's a wonderful way to take care of what a lot of people are experiencing in those situations, which is cognitive dissonance. This internal conflict with this sort of polarized way of thinking, like what you're seeing doesn't feel like it's in line with what you're feeling or what you think is going on. And cognitive dissonance starts to set in when evidence starts to come forward and things feel conflicted. And in part, again, because you might not want them to be true. But when suddenly you're faced with the truth, the pieces fall into place and it helps to solve some of this cognitive dissonance. One of the cruel things that happened to Ryan that happens to many people in these situations is that they are gaslit. They are told that something is absolutely not happening that is absolutely happening. And the leadership, sometimes parents who do this, want you to stay naive. They want you to stay in the dark. And instead of changing their ways, learning from that, thinking, you know what, I don't want to do something that is going to harm people, but I also want to, I don't want to do something that's going to affect my child that's going to make my child wonder about their parent in a horrible way, or that is going to set an example for a child who might then think it's okay to do this. And so I really do need to stop doing this, and I need to get help, and I need to realize that what I'm doing is wrong. Often, instead of doing the hard work, instead of really facing yourself and making amends, making changes, you just find a way to hide it. You find a way to lie better. And then that puts everyone in danger, especially those who will get closer to you thinking that you're safe, or who won't mind the idea of spending time alone with you because they will assume they're safe. But in addition to this, what happened to Ryan is also something that happens to a lot of people, which is they are blamed. They are blamed for what happens to them. These systems blame the victim time and time again. And the fact that Ryan was actually blamed for his father's abuse against him, his physical abuse against him, that somehow Ryan had caused it, is an important thing for us to talk about, even briefly. When Ryan is told that he made his dad abuse him and that then he was the problem, you want to look at that, because especially if someone is a child, they are not responsible for the decisions that their parents make. They are not responsible, especially, for their parents hurting them, scaring them, abusing them, neglecting them. But in a system where people don't want to have to take responsibility, they blame the others, and they'll even blame the victim and blame their child. And this sets things in motion after, where I work with a lot of people who are still very unclear about whose fault something is. And they're sure that they led someone on, or they're sure that they must have made someone angry enough to hurt them. But then they move on in their life and sometimes then get into a relationship where they give their abuser permission to abuse them. Well, I know that if I hadn't made them upset, they wouldn't have needed to treat me this way. That is not factually correct. You cannot make someone abuse you. You can sometimes give someone permission to hurt you, to harm you, if it's consensual, if that's what you want. But abuse is different. Abuse is taking someone's power away without their consent. Abuse is taking advantage of your control, of intimidating someone, of scaring them, harming them, when there was no reason for it. But also, when you become a parent, when you become an adult, the hope is that you have learned self-control. And one of the ways that you learn self-control is by realizing that is something that you need to do for the next generation. Using the fact that you were abused yourself also isn't an excuse. It can be an explanation for why you might do it to the next generation after you, but it's not an excuse. There is no excuse. It is really, truly remarkable how far Ryan has come in his life, and I'm so glad that he was able to join us on the show today. I wish him the best and hope that we get a chance to talk again. Take good care. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.